Hello, and welcome back to Hanging Out with the Dream King, a Neil Gaiman podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brent Heltz. Today in this special episode, we'll be talking about the 7 volumes that make up The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis. They were originally published 1950 through 1956.
This episode is coming to you because of a commission that we received from one of our just really, really generous Patreon supporters. And the commission, I should say, the commission really is for us to cover Neil Gaiman's own Narnia story, The Problem of Susan. We are going to do that, but that will actually be our next episode because we needed to reread The Chronicles of Narnia in order to cover The Problem of Susan. And since we were going to be doing that anyway, we decided that we ought to just do an episode about it. There will also be a 3rd episode about Narnia on the network. Not going to be on this show. That's an episode that I'm going to do with Jay Deal over on ATAZ. That'll be part of our medievalism series. And so, naturally, our interest in Narnia there, our angle into Narnia there, we'll be talking about the ways in which C.S. Lewis himself, a scholar of medieval literature, is infusing the world with bits of medieval culture. At any rate, there is then a lot of bonus content that we are doing here across the network, thanks to just one generous listener. And of course, we want to say a huge thanks to that listener for the financial support for doing this, but also the impetus to do this as well. But all right, what is this episode going to be like? Well, it certainly is not going to be exhaustive. It's one episode on the entire series. Our focus here is really on Neil Gaiman and where we see some overlap or see some influence. We'll also talk about our own responses to the books and our personal favorites. I mean, we'll pick some favorite books, I guess, and pick favorite passages from throughout the series. We will not do a big synopsis, since that's probably not necessary for most listeners, but we will give a bit of a refresher on what these books are all about, just to jog any memories that need jogging, I guess. But before we get into that, Brent, I actually want to know about your history with Narnia, because I really, even though you and I have been friends since our own youth, I don't know your history with Narnia. Did you read these books as a kid, and did they matter to you?
I did eventually read the books as a kid, although my first exposure was, as is the case with many kids, my mother read the series to me, or at least started the series to me, reading the series to me when I was younger. And then at one of the periodic yearly book fairs that we had in our school district, and it was probably once you and I were at different elementary schools, I remember being really excited that my parents gave me the money so that I could purchase the 7-volume box set of the mass market paperbacks of the books that I still have probably on my bookshelf. I'm sure that I read all of the books, at least between my mother reading them to me, and then my reading them myself. I'm assuming I read each one a minimum of probably 3 times before the age of like 10, and probably visited not at all after the age of probably 10 or 11, when I was transitioning to Dragonlance and Forgotten Realms and those kinds of things. And Neuromancer and getting into cyberpunk as I, you know, entered the tween years, right? But Narnia was a big part of, along with some of the other the Tripod series and some of the other kind of great classic series in my mind of things that were brought to me by reading to me again, my mother reading them to me first, and then me going back and consuming them myself. The Hobbit. And Lord of the Rings as well. But I think I encountered Narnia first, and Cair Paravel always kind of had a place in my heart, and a lion on a shield carries plenty of weight, and not just because of Sean Connery appearing in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves at the end. So, but what was your experience with Narnia?
Yeah, I'll just give a real minimal answer here, since I'm going to have the same conversation with Jay over on ATAZ, and I'll talk more at length about it on that episode. But yeah, my story mirrors yours here. I think probably somewhere between third and fourth grade, I had received that box set from a relative, an aunt, and these books were very, very important to me when I was a kid. But like you, and I guess this is the reason I didn't know if you had ever read them as a kid, is that that didn't carry on for me into the tween years, which is when, you know, seventh grade, you and I really started this friendship, although we had known each other as kids. It was re-encountering each other in the lunchroom and bonding over Dragonlance novels, right? Is how we got from there to here. And yeah, it sounds like you and I both had just hadn't carried these books with us into adolescence in ways that I did carry many of the books that I read as a kid with me over to adolescence, especially, you know, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. And that might be something worth thinking about. In fact, might even be something that we can think about through the lens of Neil Gaiman as we get further into this episode. But before we get to that conversation, let's go through each of the seven books and just talk briefly about what they are, just really to jog memories. I mean, our own memories included, I suppose. So let's start with book number one, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And look, this is the one that everyone thinks of when they think of Narnia. It's got snow, it's got lampposts, it's got Mr. Tumnus.
Yeah, and it's got the beavers. It is the one that, frankly, I think it's all you need. The other six are attempts at adding to it, but I think we would well remember the Chronicles of Narnia if the Chronicles of Narnia were a Chronicle of Narnia, being The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. That's all you need.
That's exactly right, Brendan. You've hit on something that probably I should have said at the start of this, which is that one of the reasons we're doing this book by book, spend a minute or two on each book here, is that this really is a series of independent books. It is not a seven-part novel the way that The Lord of the Rings is a three-part novel, right? And there is some overlap, I guess is the word we can use, right? There are characters who run through the series, but they're not in every book, and even when they are in some books, sometimes they are relegated to more minor positions and so on. But also, I think you're absolutely right about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe being a classic in its own right, whether or not any of these other books had existed. I think this is the images that we have from that book are our images of Narnia, even for people who have never read these books and don't have any direct experience of them, still look at a lamppost in the wintertime and think Narnia, right? And perhaps even take a picture of it and put it on social media with a Narnia type caption or a caption that is invoking Narnia, even if they've never actually read this book. That's how ubiquitous I think some of the images from this book are in our culture.
Plus, it's got Santa Claus in it. So
it sure does. And I think we will actually be talking about that later. But now let's turn our attention to Prince Caspian. This is the one where the human kids from Earth, from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the Pevensey family, they return to Narnia a little later in their own lives, but it's really 1,000 years later in Narnia. Their perfectly harmonious realm has been destroyed by human invaders who now subjugate, oppress, and even deny the existence of talking animals and other fantastical creatures. But this is really the story of how Prince Caspian makes it all right again with the help of the Pevenseys.
Prince Caspian, I it's a good story. I like it. It kind of would strike me if it hadn't been written and finished by C.S. Lewis prior to the publication of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which he had actually finished Prince Caspian, at least a treatment of it, before Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe hit the stands. If it had been something he wrote a couple of years after The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I would feel it to be a petty cash grab, because it seems like you had a complete story with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and you're like, let's do it again.
And this one introduces us to a lot more of the talking animals, some of whom are going to continue to be characters in the series. And I will say that when Finch, my son, was 1 and 2, we were reading some of the Narnia books together. We didn't actually make it past Prince Caspian. I say reading together, I would read them to him when he was in his crib. It was nap time or bedtime, right? And so, you know, we'd read a page, a day, basically. And we never made it past Prince Caspian. Caspian. But when I told him that I was coming into the basement today to talk with you about Narnia, those were the characters he wanted to talk to me about that he remembered. He remembered, you know, Aslan, of course, who certainly appears in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. But Reepicheep and Pattertwig were the characters that he really remembers from Narnia, which I thought was really quite delightful this morning. But what Finch doesn't know, and what I think probably you don't know either, Brent, since, as it turns out, you and I've never actually talked about Narnia together before today, I'm actually named after a character in Prince Caspian. It's Glenstorm the Centaur. I prefer to just go by Glen rather than Glenstorm, but Glenstorm the Centaur is who my parents named me after.
Well, I mean, I guess the fact that you do have the lower half of a horse and occasionally find yourself in a stable, that it, the clues are now mounting. You are perhaps partially centaur.
Right. Yeah. But now, of course, the whole reason this is a podcast and not a YouTube channel is so that listeners don't know that. But well, the beans have been spilled, I suppose. Well, let's move on to the next book here, which is The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. This is the one in which the now King Caspian sails around the ocean trying to find Aslan's realm. And he has loads of Odyssey-like adventures. Characters Edmund and Lucy Pevensey are here for this one. But so also is a new character from our world. This is their cousin Eustace, who is basically the Edmund of this story, since Edmund has been rehabilitated in the, you know, course of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
It is also a bridging of the gap, because the end of the prior book, Aslan reveals that Peter and Susan cannot return to Narnia. And so it's a matter of like, oh, well, at some point is Edmund and maybe even Lucy going to also kind of age out? So introducing Eustace, yeah, you're right, as kind of the, in some ways, more miserable Edmund, although he doesn't. He's just kind of a selfish brat. He doesn't really, you know, turn on everyone in favor of the White Queen the way that Edmund briefly does in The Lion, the Witch, the Wardrobe.
Let's move on to the next book here, which is The Silver Chair. This is the one about King Caspian's son, and in fact, the son of that star as well, right? This is the character Prince Rillian. And the story is about how he's been missing for 10 years. Eustace returns to Narnia with a schoolmate from, you know, our world, from England. This is Jill Poole. And together with a frog person named Puddleglum, they rescue Rillian and save the day.
Yeah, and Puddleglum is one of my favorite characters. I'm happy to have him there, and we'll talk about him a little bit more later. But this one I actually think stands out among kind of the sequels, which we'll talk about it as well. There's also some great imagery, also some great sense of scale, some Lovecraftian, cyclopean visages that you've got going on, vistas rather, that you've got going on as we go, which I appreciated a lot, even at the young age. I think it probably got me ready for the Mountains of Madness in some ways.
Yeah, I think there are some shared imagery there. Again, this is something we'll return to later. All right, next up is The Horse and His Boy. This is the one that takes place entirely in Narnia, with no characters crossing over from Earth, though it does still have the Pevensies. It's just years and years since they have crossed over, and the story's not from their perspective. What this story does is tell the tale of some Narnians who've been enslaved in a fictionalized version of the medieval Abbasid Caliphate, and then tells the story of their escape to Narnia. Two of these people are talking horses. One is a boy, and they are aided by a native girl who wants to escape the oppression of women in this country.
If you're looking for excuses to be offended by C.S. Lewis, then this is a book that'll definitely do it for you.
Yeah, I suspect that this is one that Jay and I are actually going to spend a lot of time on, because my feeling, at least reading the entire series, was that that's actually the place where most of the medievalism is really showing up, is in the depiction of Calormen rather than in depictions of Narnia, though there's plenty of investitures of kings and castles and so on in Narnia that Jay and I will also talk about as well. Well, we're near the end here. We've got two books left to talk about. Next up is The Magician's Nephew. This is the prequel about the creation of Narnia, thanks to some kids from late Victorian London. It's the one with the rings. It's got the origin story of the witch, and it's got the world between worlds.
It's great because it tells us that the first king of Narnia is a cabbie. There's also a lot of great potential stories that can spring to your mind as a young child and as an adult from there, with the idea that there's this the world between worlds, pool between worlds, where there's the ability to move through different areas, and one of the pools leads to Narnia, but one leads to our world, and the idea that there's all these different gates.
Right. This is the book that lets us know that actually we're dealing with a multiverse here, that we, you know, we only ever see the two worlds, but in fact, there's seemingly infinite verses, or, you know, infinite worlds in this multiverse here. And I imagine that somewhere in Lucien's library is a series that C.S. Lewis wrote about some of these other pools that the kids never actually go into. So something to look forward to if we ever actually get to, you know, consciously visit Lucien's library. But all right, we have arrived at the end here. It's the last battle now, which, as it implies in the title, is, hey, the last book. Narnia and the adjacent lands, really this world, we could say, all has to be shut down, and everyone living here has to be sent either to heaven or, you know, the other place. This book also has the return of all the Earth kids, except for Susan, which of course is how we got to this episode in the first place, though, to be clear, we will not talk about that until the next episode.
Endings are tough. Endings are hard to do, and I think they're even harder to do when you kind of want to mash up Animal Farm with the Book of Revelation.
Yeah, that's probably what it should have said on the back, although that's actually not a good way to get me to want to read a book, I don't think, but that is more or less exactly what is happening in this book. And yeah, it's the end. It does make me feel a little bittersweet, I guess, to conclude the series, but certainly on this read, what I was thinking about was the problem of Susan, which we will definitely talk about next episode. I mean, it's the topic of next episode, and, well, the actual problem of Susan as well, which is really, you know, coming from this book. Well, all right, we have gone through each of the books here with hopefully enough detail to jog everyone's memory, but not so much detail that people who are really familiar with these books have checked out. So let's get into talking about Neil Gaiman here. And I'm going to begin with really just a personal anecdote about the time that I went to a Neil Gaiman book signing at the Tattered Cover in Denver, gosh, 20 years ago now, or close to it at any rate. I guess not quite 20 years ago, but close to 20 years ago, when he was on tour for Anansi Boys. I got myself a copy. And of course, Brent, you have on your shelf a copy that I got for you as well at that signing. This was a line around the building type of signing. I actually got there hours and hours before the event was meant to begin. So I at least was inside the building the whole time, though only barely inside. Gaiman was signing books late into the night. I mean, the store had closed down. I think I got home about 1 a.m., maybe even a little bit closer to 2 a.m. That night, and was, you know, still maybe even only in the middle, actually, of the line at that point. But of course, before the signing, Gaiman did a reading, and he also took some questions. And I don't remember what the question was that prompted him talking about Narnia, but something that stands out to me from this event. In fact, it's the only thing I really remember him saying, other than, you know, when I talked with him when he was actually signing our books for us. But the thing that I remember from this event is him talking about Narnia and talking about how reading the Chronicles of Narnia as a kid was the moment when he said, I want to do this too. I want to tell stories, and I want to tell stories like this. And I think even if we didn't have him saying that, I think we could still tell that, right? My sense, Brent, is that the narrator of these Narnia books, who is actually a kind of character in the books that we never learn who that is, and maybe it is actually C.S. Lewis, but it is still a presence in the books. The voice of this narrator and Gaiman's own narrative voice in a lot of material, to me, share an awful lot of overlap, that they sound very similar in a lot of places.
I think when he's talked about this publicly in other places, he's described it as the narrator talking to him without being kind of patronizing or dismissive, but talking to him, kind of meeting children where they're at, but without talking down to them. And that very much is something that in this reread I was reminded of, that that it's something the narrator does very well here, is talk to you in kind of an equal way that isn't just – it's not just expository. There's a fair amount of kind of other commentary for good and for ill that is kind of laced in there, but it's always kind of written in such a way as to be like, let me put this in the context that you'll best understand, but not in a way that's like, let me explain it to you so that, you know, with very small words. It's not that kind of a narrator. And I think that it does kind of carry across that. And I think that we see in Neil Gaiman's writing where his narrator, similarly, he strives to have them kind of meet the audience kind of where they are. And that way it's kind of the narrator kind of confides in you. And it creates kind of a sense of trust. But also a sense of kind of that even if things are not going as you want them to be, like the narrator and you, or the two of you, understand what is right or wrong about a given situation. And you're just kind of acknowledging this shared understanding and kind of pulling from shared values in some ways.
Well, I thought it might be useful here, Brent, to share maybe just a few handful of passages that stood out to us as, you know, potentially being written by Gaiman, right? I guess that maybe the game would be who wrote this, C.S. Lewis or Neil Gaiman. And, you know, we invoked the stars earlier when we were talking about The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And there was a passage here that really, if you had just given this to me without me having recently reread The Chronicles of Narnia and asked me if this is something Neil Gaiman wrote or just told me this is something from a draft of Neil Gaiman's next book, I would have absolutely believed it. We have the character Eustace here say, "In our world, a star is a huge ball of burning gas." And then we have another character here say, "Even in your world, my son, that is not what a star is, but only what it is made of." And this just feels to me like this is actually something that Neil Gaiman has written his own variation of in many different places.
It's an acknowledging kind of the perception is not necessarily what things are and that there's kind of underlining platonic essences within things. C.S. Lewis also, you know, very directly is using things as signifiers of other things. And I think Neil Gaiman does that as well. It's a little less heavy-handed in Neil's writing, although in part because he is standing on the shoulder of C.S. Lewis and many other writers who've come before. So we've created kind of an understanding that you don't need to say, this is supposed to be a metaphor, and therefore it's a simile. Instead, it's you can just go with the metaphor in some ways.
And you could do this with the Sandman. And in fact, I think we're going to eventually in the Sandman see some places, and I'm trying to be a little cagey here, but there's a particular moment in the Sandman that this reminded me of. We just haven't gotten there yet. We're a no spoiler podcast, so I'm just going to not say exactly what that is. But I think that we could even think about this as how the dreaming works at all, or what dreams are, I guess, right? That you could have a character in the Sandman say, you know, or describe, I guess, dreams as a kind of neurological process, a sort of chemical thing happening in our brains. And another character say, well, you've just described you've just described how they work, but not really what they are, right? That's how dreams get to you, or that's some part of how the engine of the dream is working, but that's not what a dream is, right? And this, I think, really is the way that Gaiman, especially when he is doing some type of magical realism, this is how he is doing it. This is how he is perceiving the relationship between the mundane world that we all see and the magical world that lies behind it, or the numinous world that lies behind it. Well, there's one more passage I want us to talk about here, Brent, before we move on. Some of this is just because I thought this was a particularly fun passage. But again, this is something that if you told me this was in Neil Gaiman's upcoming or forthcoming kids book, I would 100% believe it. This is actually from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Lewis writes, "Ogres with monstrous teeth and wolves and bull-headed men, spirits of evil trees and poisonous plants, and other creatures whom I won't describe, because if I did, the grown-ups would probably not let you read this book." And this is a passage, I think, that illustrates something you were talking about earlier, Brent, which is, when Gaiman is thinking about the way a narrator talks to a juvenile audience, a young audience, an audience of kids, talking to them without talking down to them. And of course, something that kids always experience is the oppression of adults. I mean, even if that oppression is, you know, from parents who love you or adults who love you and coming from a place of love, I'm speaking as a parent myself here, right? That still nonetheless feels like oppression. And this is a place where Lewis is really bringing the kids into a kind of shared secret world, right? Something where this is, you know, between us, acknowledging that the grownups are there and that they're kind of a problem. And it just struck me that this is very much the way that Gaiman, I think, addresses his young audience in many of his kids' books as well.
Yeah, I think that Gaiman does a good job in a lot of his kids' books of acknowledging, I mean, his kids' books, he acknowledges kind of the authoritarian otherness of parents in some ways. On his kind of slightly kind of middle years books, I'm thinking of Coraline here, which you and I have not discussed on the network yet, but there's kind of the comfort of your real parents, but also how the twisting of that and the terror if suddenly you realize what you're interacting with is not your real parent, and then kind of the powerlessness with which you can feel that, and the isolation of that. And I think that there's a lot of power that Gaiman takes advantage of in discussing and being aware of kind of the situational relationship between parents and children, which many writers in fiction do this extremely well when it comes to kind of, I'm thinking in the, you know, classic high-minded, you know, literary fiction, if you will. Picture all the snobbiness I can when saying that, which is meant in condescension, but which it's always usually just like middle-aged adult human comes to grips with relationship with older parent figure that may or may not still be, you know, with us. But I think that Gaiman does a great job of leveraging it in terms of the relationship between still living parent and still living child at the point in which the child is a child and like looking at that relationship. And so it makes him a very smart writer, in part because I assume he was a pretty self-aware parent when his children were of the age. We'll never know until the autobiographies come out, the tell-alls.
Well, we've kind of wandered into something, Brent, that we have a little bit lower down on our episode outline here. But let's go ahead and jump ahead to that now, which is to just talk a little bit about the way that Lewis is writing about children here and also the way that Gaiman writes about children. Something that I have talked about, well, maybe a little bit we have talked about together here on this show, but when I was a guest on the Ray Bradbury show, the Bradbury Chronicles, something that we talked about there was the way that Bradbury writes about children and the way that Gaiman writes about children, there being a big overlap there. And the, you know, the impetus for that, the reason that I was invited onto that show, for which I was very grateful, that was a lot of fun, was because you and I had recently covered October in the Chair, which is dedicated to Ray Bradbury's story, you know, about kids, right? And very much taking its cues from Ray Bradbury, who also writes about children in this very sophisticated way. But I was really struck this time reading the Chronicles of Narnia, that a lot of what Gaiman is doing with kids, I think, you know, draws certainly on his own experience of having been a kid, but also seems in many ways to be filtered through the way that Lewis is writing about kids here as well.
I actually found, in thinking about this topic as I was reading through Narnia this time, to find how much I prefer the way the children are depicted in Neil Gaiman's stories versus in the Narnia books, the children and many of the other characters just come across far more simplistic, not necessarily simple-minded, but just we've got the characters kind of standing in for things and the children kind of being, you know, fully focused on one particular thing. And I feel with Neil Gaiman, he identifies two or three things that are motivating the child at any given moment. And one of those things maybe is at the reins as to what action is going to be taken next or inaction by the child, but that there's multiple things that the child has going on in their internal narrative. While with C.S. Lewis, I feel like, no, we're kind of given, it is what it looks like. Here's the one thing driving the child until that gets resolved. And then there's another thing that drives the child. And also, there doesn't seem to be a lot of in the case of Edmund, we see some growth. But otherwise, I feel like we don't necessarily see as much growth in the other children. Lucy, who many readers kind of identify far more with, is pretty stays pretty constant throughout her appearances in some ways, I feel like. And then at a certain point, when Lucy is not on the set anymore, we bring in Jill, and Jill feels like an initially skeptical, but then might as well, you know, cross out her name and write in Lucy when she appears in my mind in like the last battle and stuff. So I struggled a little bit here with the representation of the children, just because I feel like they were just a little more simply written. But again, Gaiman has the advantage of writing to sometimes slightly older audience, but also the advantage that most of the readers have already read books like the Chronicles of Narnia. So you don't need to, you can kind of play off the signifiers that C.S. Lewis and others, Ray Bradbury and others, have kind of already established. And even if you haven't read the books, they're enough kind of in the cultural zeitgeist and awareness that you can kind of play with the expectations, or at least rely on the audience to know those things in a way. But I found the children to be kind of straight-faced in that way here. And at times very spiteful too. I'm imagining when they return in, I think it's the Silver Chair where they return and they're being, you know, being bullied. But their response is to show up with weapons, swords, and like run after them. And they're supposed to use the flat of the sword, but still in America in the early 21st century, I have a very different and cold reaction to the idea of children who feel bullied showing up with weapons to a school in a way that, obviously was not a consideration at all in the 1950s for anyone, thankfully, for folks in that time, not to be pro-bullying.
I'm actually not sure how well that would have played in the 1950s either. And in fact, a big part of that story is C.S. Lewis complaining about the turn that schools have taken since the Second World War, or certainly since his own childhood. And that I think C.S. Lewis maybe has a very different pedagogical philosophy than you and I do, for sure. And even than our own parents would have. So I'm not sure even, you know, contemporary adult readers, how they would have felt about that. But yeah, that was something that struck me as well. But yeah, I had a very different reaction, I think, to the way Lewis is writing children than you did. I found these children to be very much alive, very much fully drawn here. I mean, I think that maybe the Pevensies less so than some of the other characters. I guess I was really thinking more about Eustace and about Shasta, who are the characters, the protagonist characters that really stood out to me, human protagonist characters, I guess I should say, because Puddleglum definitely, I think, takes the cake there for me. But yeah, I thought these characters, these kids, were actually quite well drawn. And one of the things that I guess I was thinking about here and saying that I like the way that Lewis writes these kids, and I see a lot of that similarity in what Gaiman does, is that these kids are not little angels, that they're treating each other pretty poorly, not even just the kind of, I guess not technically, but more or less anonymous bullies of Eustace and Jill at their school, but just even the way that, well, one, Eustace and Jill talk to each other, but then especially the way that the Pevensey siblings all talk to each other. To me, that felt very real and felt very different from so much other literature that's for kids, in which kids are always nice, unless they're not, in which case then you know that that person is the baddie. And I've been reading a fair bit of literature that's aimed at the same age group as these books. I mean, these are, you know, books I'm reading with Finch, right? Thinking here about the Boxcar Children, the Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew. And for the most part, those books don't have kids behaving this way. They don't have kids sniping at each other. They don't have kids being bad siblings to each other. In fact, usually quite the opposite. Or, you know, if it does happen, it's the moral of the story, right? It's the lesson of the story, is that you shouldn't say mean things to your siblings or something like that. I think Lewis and Gaiman both are looking at children without those kind of, I don't know, that type of lens on, right? They're seeing children for the whole people that they really are. And so that was something that, yeah, I thought they had in common here.
I think that, I mean, that's fair. I kind of stand by what I said before, but I think that it is fair to say that where we do have some complexity, it is in showing the children of kind of being at times terrible to each other and terrible to others. I'm thinking about where the fearsome foursome encounter a dwarf who they don't particularly like. He's kind of miserable, but they decide to call him what, our darling little fellow, and then call him the DLF. And he's like, please don't call me that. And they like continue to do that for the rest of the time to everyone's great enjoyment, except for his. And it's just like, yeah, that's you're terrible bullies. Like there's many things you could complain about this dwarf, but like you should not pick his height as the thing that you're going to continue to pick on. That's gross and awful. But these are our protagonists. And in the end, as long as they believe in a lion, I guess everything's good, which is kind of the limits of moralizing of Lewis, which probably you and Jay will talk about. I think that it is fair to say, particularly Eustace does do a fair amount of growth. And I think it is, you are correct to point out that Shasta does have, or Shasta, I'm not sure, does have a fair, we get a fair amount of inner thoughts of his in a way that shows, I think, some growth in the years from when we had the interior monologue of the fearsome foursome before that, for him to think about how they interact. I always think about the children, particularly when I think about Edmund and I think about Peter, kind of the older versions of them, particularly Edmund, and just after Lawrence and the Witch of the Wardrobe, he just kind of is bland to me. Cause it's just like, he's had his arc and it's done. And so other than being kind of mean to people based on height, like he's just like, he's there and he's great and he's good. And that's it, kind of.
Yeah, the Pevensey siblings are never really the kids that the stories are about. And so this is definitely a place where Lewis and Gaiman differ. And also, yeah, Ray Bradbury differs from C.S. Lewis here as well, where this is, I think, where or why, rather, we don't get a lot of the interiority that I think you're pointing to and saying that you prefer, that we do get in Gaiman and do also get in Bradbury. And, you know, there are lots of reasons for that. One of them is simply that Lewis isn't very interested in that type of storytelling, at least not in these books. He is in some of the other books that he's written, but he's not very interested in that here. But I think also one of the issues with that is that he has four protagonists, right, in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And that is something that's difficult to juggle. And I think that's where we see this difference with The Horse and His Boy, where we mostly are getting that story from the perspective of Shasta. And so we actually get a lot more interiority in that story. And I think this is something that Gaiman tends to do, that also Ray Bradbury tends to do, which is to tell a story from really one character's point of view that allows us to be internal, allows us to be interior in that character's mind and in that character's persona and experiences, which is not something that Lewis is doing. And I think that's, you know, I think that was really where you were approaching this, you know, this question or this topic that I had put on the outline from. And I think we'll maybe revisit some of these experiences of kids when we talk about stories and storytelling. But I want to backtrack us here because I just also want to point out some other places where I think that we are seeing Neil Gaiman being inspired by or even sometimes making some clear allusions to Narnia in other things that we have read. I've actually got maybe too long of a list here, Brent, so I won't go through all of them. But one that really, one that jumped out to me, of course, I mean, yeah, it has to be one that we talk about here, is that in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, there is an island in the sea where dreams physically manifest, where they come true, so to speak, right? And these are real dreams, not daydreams. And this, of course, is a real, well, I was about to say it's a nightmare scenario. Not meaning that to be a double entendre there, but this is a bad scenario for the people on the Dawn Treader when they get here. This is a real obstacle to be overcome. This is actually a really scary episode. I remember being scared by this chapter when I was, reading this at, I guess, must have been age 9, I suppose. I remember being scared of this episode. Reading it this time, I say, oh yeah, this is very much the dreaming here.
Something else similarly that struck me was particularly with Aslan, where a creature has different forms outwardly that it appears to be. And it reminds me a lot of when we've seen Morpheus as a cat versus, you know, the different kind of aspects he's chosen to take, depending on who he's interacting with. I'm picturing him interacting with Nada versus him interacting with, you know, folks in 1980s, 1990s London. But specifically him, cat him versus human him. Is something I thought of when we encountered Lamb Aslan versus Lion Aslan versus him referencing that he appears something different in our world, you know, Jesus. So we've got, you know, the human and different animal appearances all dependent on the perspective of where you're sitting and what's kind of going on in the situation. But it nonetheless, you know, the heart of the thing is the same thing. Was another place that struck me as similar.
Yeah, I agree completely. And here I just want to paraphrase Firefly and say, Captain, when do we get to go to the fantasy novel where Bast is Jesus? Because I would certainly read that novel. I think that could be an awful lot of fun. Yeah, some other places where we get some overlaps here, or just passages, I guess, maybe that made me chuckle and made me think about Neil Gaiman. One here that I thought was really interesting is that Uncle Andrew in The Magician's Nephew, his Uncle Andrew here really is the magician, right? He claims that his godmother was one of the last people to have fairy blood. We don't get too much more about that, but presumably it's because fairies have gone away, right? And obviously that is an idea we have encountered in Gaiman. We've also, you know, seen that in some other places, you know, when we covered Kipling, for example, but it really jumped out to me here. And I, you know, just imagined Gaiman himself as a kid reading this book and internalizing this idea that it used to be the case that fairies were around and in fact, sometimes had children with humans, so that there used to be people who were, you know, part fairy in some way or had a fairy ancestor. That's no longer the case. And that's a cause for sadness in the world.
And another thing that struck me as similar between the two is the idea that, you know, the connections between worlds sometimes can be pretty strong and constant. Like, you know, the rings will work. The rings worked, you know, for the magician and were used at the time. But then there's also the discussion in the last battle of like, oh, we should use the rings again if we dig them up. But then there's things like the wardrobe or the painting that took them to the Dawn Treader, where these end up being almost single use, or I guess for the wardrobe, but it's, you know, three or four use items and then that's it. So kind of the connection between worlds being something that at times can be stable and at other places can be very unstable, but there's multiple ways to access Narnia, but they're not all predictable and they may not work more than once. And that's something I think we see a fair amount in writings by Neil Gaiman, where he has kind of the interaction of particularly, you know, the lands of fairy and earth, but in other places too, where we've got this, there's, you know, there's bridges that are solid and then there's doors that you can only go through once. It's definitely something that he's explored a fair amount in his writing.
Yeah, there's not the power creep, right, in the Narnia books the way that we get in so much contemporary fantasy now. And I think that's also the case for Gaiman, right? This kind of lack of power creep where the world has some rules and the world is going to be the world, right? The setting of the story is going to be the setting of the story and the characters are going to have to live in that world as conceived by either Lewis or Gaiman here. You know, ongoing creation, of course, right, for both writers, and I guess here especially if we're thinking about comparing Narnia to Sandman as serialized storytelling that's not published all at the same time after years of editing and thinking about it. I see a lot of the same impulses in both of these writers on those lines. Well, look, I said I have a pretty long list here, Brent. I mean, literally, it's 3 pages long. I'm not going to go through it all, as I promised both you and listeners, but there's one more that I want to invoke here. In fact, I really want to read some text here, because we have spent a lot of time this year ourselves talking about Sherlock Holmes on our bonus series on Patreon. Here is something else that Lewis writes in The Magician's Nephew. This is a story about something that happened long ago when your grandfather was a child. In those days, Mr. Sherlock Holmes was still living in Baker Street, and the Bastables were looking for treasure in the Lewisham Road. Now, obviously, just the thinking about, we ourselves have spent a lot of time thinking about and talking about Holmes this year. You know, and the point of that was to read Neil Gaiman's own Sherlock Holmes fan fiction. That's something that jumps out on its own. But what I really love about this passage is that in the world of Narnia, Sherlock Holmes was a real person. And so were the Bastables, the characters from another set of kids' books. And I think this is how Neil Gaiman operates as well. The idea that characters from stories that we all know and love are real, that they might as well also exist in our world. I really, really loved that, you know, just finding that line here. And it's a throwaway line. It's just telling us when this story is set and then it never comes back. But what a magical way to do that. Well, this is a good transition to talking about the last item on our agenda here. I mean, not for the whole episode, but for thinking about Neil Gaiman and the Chronicles of Narnia, which is to talk about stories and storytelling, the way that Lewis and Gaiman do this. And, you know, again, here, I think there's maybe a lot to say. I don't want to run through everything, but the big takeaway that I had here, or what struck me upon this reading of the Chronicles of Narnia, is the way that Lewis uses knowledge of stories as a kind of tool for the kids, right? The idea being that stories equip us, you know, the people who encounter them, readers of stories, equip us for the world. And there are a lot of examples of this. I won't go through them all, but just a handful of them are that Eustace, for example, has not read the right books to be equipped for Narnia. And this is actually a big motif of The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, that he never read books about dragons. So he doesn't know about dragons and a host of other things that he just doesn't know about because he's not been reading fantasy stories, essentially. But also in that book, it turns out it's not only fantasy stories that kids need to be reading in order to be fully equipped for the world, because Edmund in this book is aided in solving the mystery of what has happened to Eustace, which is that he's turned into a dragon. But Edmund is really aided in solving this by the fact that he was the only one in the group to have read several detective stories, which meant that, you know, he knew how to go about solving mysteries in ways that the other kids did not, because they just didn't have this experience of reading detective stories. Phenomenal. And then we get another one, and this will be the last one I invoke here, but we get another something like this in The Horse and His Boy, where the narrator says this: "It was a crazy idea, and if he had read as many books as you have about journeys over deserts, he would never have dreamed of it. But Shasta had read no books at all." There's a real sadness there, right? Imagining a childhood devoid of books. I mean, that's not just a sad thing. That's a real tragic. That actually would strike me as abusive, right? But the idea that, yeah, the way that you can know things about the world, or the wider world, things that are not your direct experience, it comes from books, comes from stories, right? This is a major motif of Narnia, but as we know, as we talk about all the time, it is a major motif of The Sandman and I think everything that Gaiman has written.
It's definitely woven throughout Lewis's work and Gaiman's work, kind of the powers of stories. One thing that clearly Lewis explores is, you know, with the passage of time, and here, you know, he takes advantage often of the fact that many years, sometimes hundreds of years pass between when the children from our world visit and when we as the reader visit these worlds, have passed in Narnia, so that things have become forgotten or sometimes muddled as to what happened because the people who actually were there have gone, but the stories have been passed on from, you know, talking animal to talking animal over time. And I think that when I was young, and I should have mentioned this earlier when we were talking about our exposures as children first to Narnia, but I remember how powerful it was at the beginning of Prince Caspian when the children arrive and they return to Narnia and they first don't recognize that they're at Caer Paravel. They're at their castle that had been their home for decades and decades as they grew up in Narnia before they returned and were children again in Earth. But to see it in ruins, and I remember feeling kind of very sad about that because of the passage of time and everyone that they knew, you know, has, you know, most likely has died at this point, but also thinking about what kind of carries on with time and what, you know, gets carried forward with that. And that Narnia books really had me think about that in a lot of ways that then is also the thing that I found most interesting. When I read the Dune series by Frank Herbert, one of the things I really enjoyed more than the individual characters was thinking about kind of the structural effects of decisions that were made and also how the tale and the history of things would be recorded to those who would come hundreds of years later. And obviously this is something that is visited a lot in literature. 1984 has, you know, lots of discussion about how you can have authoritarian governments that abuse how stories are carried on and who controls the writing of the history, and helps interpret or tell people how to interpret information and facts so that things can be reversed, and doublespeak can occur, or, things can simply be rewritten. You know, the magazine can be redone. But Narnia does this great thing where we think about stories and we think about the power that they serve in carrying forth these tales. And it's really something I appreciated a lot in the later books. And by later, I mean chronologically later, not necessarily in written order, is characters being like, oh, wait, did you know my grandfather? And were you the person who, you know, were you the Reepy Cheep who journeyed on the Dawn Treader? And like, there's a great power to the idea that people have heard stories of these things that have happened. They've heard the story of, you know, the high kings and queens of Narnia, but it's hundreds of years since anyone has seen or heard from them. And there's just a lot of great kind of power in the story, and also thinking about how the story is carried, and also in the last battle, people taking advantage of people not fully getting the whole story or not understanding the story well enough so that they, you know, fear approaching Aslan instead of just, you know, walking up and assuming that you can freely approach the lion. Like the idea that the lion is not a tame lion. It's like that doesn't mean what those talking animals thought that it meant, which led to many of their deaths. Right. So, there's a lot of powerful discussion of storytelling and the power of it. And also the abuse that can occur because of things that are lost as stories are passed.
Yeah. I hadn't really thought about the fact that in many instances, the characters of our stories are themselves coming out of stories, right? That they're characters, not just in the story that we're reading, but that stories, other characters in the story we are reading tell, right? That's an onion that perhaps is difficult to peel there by grammar, perhaps problematic. But yeah, that hadn't occurred to me. But of course, this is something that we see in Gaiman. We can just point to, you know, people like Orpheus and Calliope, right, as an example of that here. I guess Bast as well, who I, you know, talked about earlier, made a joke about earlier, that, yeah, all of that's happening. It also can, of course, be real people. You know, we've had Augustus and Emperor Norton as well, that Gaiman is using in this way. Yeah, great observation there, Brent. I had not thought about that at all. There's one last thing that I want to bring up here. Well, maybe there's two, but the big one is this. And this is going back to The Horse and His Boy, which is quite a bit about storytelling. And here I want to just read a passage. This is just the narrator talking here. In Kellerman, storytelling, whether the stories are true or made up, is a thing you're taught, just as English boys and girls are taught essay writing. The difference is that people want to hear the stories, whereas I never heard of anyone who wanted to read the essays. And that's not really where quite the point that I want to get to here. There's more that I want to bring in. But wow, that is true. And something I've been thinking about in my capacity as a teacher lately. But what I really want to bring up here, Brent, is that in this part of the story, what's going on here is that this character, Aravis, is telling her story, right? The story of her and her talking horse, Wynne. Wynne objects to being misquoted by Aravis in this story. But Bree, the other talking horse here, overrules the objection because this is how it is done in the Grand Kellermine Manor. And this really reminds me of Gaiman's, you know, big idea, especially in The Sandman, right? That stories can still be true, even if they didn't really happen. All right. The last thing that I want to say on this topic, and then we can move into really what will be the closing of our episode here, is just a line from the magician's nephew, the character Diggory, who is, in fact, the magician's nephew, says this. He says, grown-ups are always thinking of uninteresting explanations. And this, the context for this, right, this comes up in the context of Diggory and his friend attempting to solve a kind of mystery in their houses, and they're brainstorming about what are the possible solutions to this mystery. And of course, there are some mundane explanations that they know are possible, or they know that, you know, grown-ups will give them. And this is where Diggory says this, right? The idea that grown-ups are boring, right? That all of the answers that they're coming up with that are fueled by all of the different stories that they have read, you know, really interesting, really engaging stories, magical stories, right? That the answers inspired, or the solutions inspired by their reading, make the world more interesting, make the world better than the real answer, the real solution to this, which is uninteresting. Right? Grown-ups have to live in this uninteresting world, or this world of uninteresting explanations, but kids get to live in this world of magic because they are living in this world of stories. You know, just really kind of one line here, but it felt very profound to me.
I think there's a few ways to read that one. In some ways, it is very profound and very kind of fun to think about from a children's perspective. It also, though, to me, as someone who has spent a lot of time thinking about some things, sometimes really understanding things, the answers become less simple the more you know, the more you learn about it, the less you understand about it. And it leads to more questions sometimes. And so it can strike as somewhat simplistic to think the adults are just finding the easy way out, and also like a failure to properly romanticize even simple answers at times, because there's power in those, I think. Also, though, I think it's a fun commentary on kind of an Occam's razor thing, where if you're finding the answer to be the most simplistic is likely the answer, then you know, that's less fun in appearance. But again, if the answer to one question begets more questions, then I think there's a power there that is not necessarily understood by a juvenile audience the way it can be appreciated maybe by people as they get older.
Yeah, Lewis here is not thinking about nerdy interests that you and I have. That's not what he's writing about here. He's not writing about people who get really interested in astrophysics or archaeology or something like that. He's talking here about people who explain why you're missing a sock is simply because you've lost it, rather than because some magical creature stole it out of the dryer, right? That's what he's talking about here. And we live in that world. We live in the world where, yeah, sometimes our socks just disappear and there is nothing magical about it. But kids get to live in that world where there could be something magical about it. And I think Lewis is seeing that as a positive thing, something that children have that adults don't have, that we lose, right? That we lose as becoming adults. And that this is something that Lewis laments here, even though we are all living in a world that can really kind of only exist, you know, a material world, an institutional world that can only exist because adults are not running around describing fantastical, magical, supernatural explanations to mundane things, that, you know, the world needs us to do that, needs us to leave that behind in order to function. But it still, it can be seen as a cause of sadness here. I think that's really the perspective that Lewis has. Well, all right, Brent, I think that's maybe not entirely wrapping up a conversation that we could have about Neil Gaiman and the Chronicles of Narnia. And of course, we should invite our Patreon supporters to come chat with us about this further on our Discord server, because I think there is still a lot more to say. And I would love to hear listeners talk about this as well. But let's move on to talking about our favorites. We're going to pick some favorite passages here, just some beautiful prose or interesting prose, something that we like that we want to share with each other and with the audience. But let's start with the broad before we move into the specific, and just talk about our favorite book, I guess. Which of these seven Chronicles of Narnia, Brent, was your favorite?
I think Lion, Witch, the Wardrobe is the definitive book of the series, and in that way. It is both my favorite, and also I immediately decided it was a boring answer to give, and so I would dismiss it and say that the question you really want to know is, of the other six, what is my favorite? And you can tell me on your response whether you agree with me there or not. But looking at the other six, so what would be the runner-up if Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe were in the picture? I really think, particularly on this reread, enjoyed most The Silver Chair. I enjoy the overland travel. I loved Puddleglum. I loved kind of the imagery in terms of when they meet the green lady on the road and then, voyage to, the underworld, deep into the earth after escaping the giants. Escaping the giants was great, and kind of the it's a cookbook nature of To Serve Man. has some great bits in it, and you see exactly, what's going to happen there, but it doesn't matter because it's just fun to see how it unravels out. It allows an excuse, though, to kind of depict the horrifying existence of kind of the what it's like to for everyone to exist in the underworld, and particularly for the prince who is trapped there, and kind of the brainwashed side of him, most of the day, and having dinner with him and then learning like, oh no. And then seeing him trapped in the silver chair itself. And then the freak, like there's just a lot of excitement there. I also like the fact that, she tries to then stop them from foiling her evil plans by, putting some drugs on a fire or intoxicants of some kind to, plus play some music to try to lull them all to sleep, which I think is just a great, it's just, it isn't like, her, pull off her face and she's really like, a manticore or something. It's like, no, she's just going to try to continue to lull you to sleep with, lies and also inhaling intoxicants. The answer is Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. But if I don't pick that, it's Silverchair is my response. But what about for you?
Exactly the same. And in fact, I now regret that we didn't play a drinking game about this. But yeah, my note here is Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and then parentheses, obviously, meaning that, it's the obvious answer. This is the one that captures my imagination. As we said at the top of the show, it's the one that I think about every time it snows, basically, which sadly is less frequently than it ought to be. But yeah, I was also really surprised, actually, that my runner-up answer was The Silver Chair. Because this is a book that I did not like when I was a kid. And in fact, when I was looking through what are these seven books getting ready for this project, or really, I guess, getting ready to read them with Finch, which was 2 years ago now at this point, I couldn't remember what Prince Caspian was about or The Silver Chair. All the others, I knew what they were about, could remember the names of characters, could call up scenes, couldn't remember anything about The Silver Chair, didn't remember what it was about at all, remembered that I didn't like it very much, and that in fact, I think I had probably skipped it on rereads, which is also part of why all the others were, etched in my mind, and this one was not. But I was riveted by it. It's an amazing sword and sorcery story. It feels quite a bit like a really great D&D campaign. And I really, really loved it. And of course, as you have said yourself, Brent, one of the things that I loved about this also is the imagery. I really, really enjoyed the landscape descriptions here. And in fact, I'm intending to read at least one of them into the microphone. I don't know if you are as well, Brent, but maybe that's a good segue here into our last segment, which is just reading some of our favorite bits of Narnia to our audience. And here, I'll let you go first again, even if you might be stealing some of my thunder here. What's the first one you want to read?
I'm not going to steal your thunder on landscapes, at least, but from The Silver Chair, I will read my first one, which is, this is in response to after they meet Puddleglum and talking about the route ahead. And Eustace Scrub says that he doesn't think that Aslan would send them if it's so terrible, because Puddleglum's going on about how difficult it will be. Then we're told, quote, he, a scrub, quite expected the Marshwiggle to give him an angry reply, but he only said, "That's the spirit, Scrub. That's the way to talk. Put a good face on it. But we all need to be very careful about our tempers, seeing all the hard times we shall have to go through together. Won't do to quarrel, At any rate, don't begin it too soon. I know these expeditions usually end that way, knifing one another. I shouldn't wonder all before all's done. But the longer we can keep off it, And then it continues, well, if you feel it's so hopeless, interrupted Scrub, I think you'd better stay behind. Pull and I can go on alone, can't we, Pull? Shut up and don't be an ass, Scrub, said Jill hastily, terrified lest the Marshwiggle should take him at his word. Anyway, so I love the characterization here of Puddle Glum of just kind of calling it like it is. And, you know, clearly he's, you know, suffering from depression, but just being very class half empty view of things versus, you know, the energetic, you know, Eustace, who's, you know, used to daring do on the high seas. So daring do on land should be no problem. But I love the discussion here. And also just the visualization in Narnia of people literally knifing one another. Silverchair has got a lot of these elements where it's like, this is clearly written assuming that the reader is a little older than the person who is reading Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah, this is actually, I think, one of the elements where this felt very sword and sorcery to me. And I mean, many of the things here, you know, that you've invoked felt very sword and sorcery to me. But the idea that knifing one another is a thing that travelers do, deep into a journey, felt out of place for the other Narnia stories and for stories for little kids, certainly, but felt right at home in a Robert E. Howard story or a Favard Gray-Mouser story or something like that. Absolutely. I mean, it felt like Waterdeep or something, right? And I guess I was sort of struck here, Brent, while you were reading that passage, that you might actually be Puddle Glum. You're certainly the Puddle Glum of Play Temple Media in having the pessimistic worldview and fretting about things from that perspective, which I hadn't realized that before. But that may also have been part of the subconscious joy that I was getting out of reading The Silver Chair, is that it felt like maybe you, me, and Brandon were actually on an adventure. And obviously you are Puddle Glum.
And Puddle Glum is just, in defense of me/Puddle Glum, he is a realist. He knows exactly how it's going to play out. He is the only one that stops them from being immediately taken in on the road when Jill's like, oh, let's tell this nice lady everything about where we're going to go. And Puddle Glum's like, maybe we stay a little cagey about things. Maybe we don't trust people on the road just implicitly. Because Puddle Glum is set up as the adult of the story who at times, like, you know, the children are going to do what the children are going to do. And he's kind of along for the ride. But he also does occasionally reel things in with the maturity that they simply don't have.
While you were talking, Brent, I just looked up the word realism in the Oxford English Dictionary, and it says, and here I'm quoting, realism is the term that pessimists use for pessimism. you are proving my point even as you are defending yourself, though unnecessarily defending yourself. I mean, you're the one who's going to keep us all alive, just like Puddle Glum did.
Hope for the best, plan for the worst. So what was your first passage? Did you want to go to your silver chair, or are they both silver chair?
I will save my silver chair passage for last, just in case. I want to make sure you've got crack at it here. So I am going to take for my first passage here one from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And in fact, quite early on in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And this is the narrator describing the house where the Pevensey children are taking refuge from the Blitz. It was the sort of house that you never seemed to come to the end of, and it was full of unexpected places. The first few doors they tried led only into spare bedrooms, as everyone had expected that they would. But soon they came to a very long room full of pictures, and there they found a suit of armor. And after that was a room all hung with green, with a harp in one corner. And then came three steps down and five steps up, and then a kind of little upstairs hall, and a door that led out onto a balcony. And then a whole series of rooms that led into each other and were lined with books, most of them very old books, and some bigger than a Bible in a church. And shortly after that, they looked into a room that was quite empty, except for one big wardrobe. And what I love about this description, right, is, well, one, I would, I suppose, love to live in a house that has enough space for all of my books. But really what appeals to me about this, of course, is the magic, right? The way in which this house, it's obviously a big house, right? The type of house that most of us do not get to live in, that most of us can't afford to live in a home like this, right? But nonetheless, it is a house. It's a mundane structure, you know, made of wood and brick and nails and glass and so on. But for the kids, it is 100% magical, all of it. I mean, you know, one part of it absolutely is, right? The wardrobe itself, but even just the hallway with the pictures and the suit of armor, the weird balcony for some reason in the middle of a house, all of that has this kind of magic, right? And this is one of the ways in which Lewis writes not just about children, but writes from the perspective of children that I really, really appreciated. Well, all right, Brent, what's the other passage that you want to share with people here?
So I probably could have gone with several others from the Silver Chair, but I tried to space things out. And so I struggled a fair amount with the last battle, but there was one particular passage that I really enjoyed from it. And so I'm going to go ahead and share it. It's in chapter 8. It's after Jill and Eustace have shown up and met up with the king, and they're trying to figure out what to do next, but they're going for a walk. And Jill says, "Oh, this is nice," said Jill, "just walking along like this. I wish there could be more of this sort of adventure. It's a pity there's always so much happening in Narnia." But the unicorn explained to her that she was quite mistaken. He said that the sons and daughters of Adam and Eve were brought out of their own strange world into Narnia only at times when Narnia was stirred and upset, but she mustn't think it was always like that. In between their visits, there were hundreds and thousands of years when peaceful king followed peaceful king till you could hardly remember their names or count their numbers, and there was really hardly anything to put into the history books. And he went on to talk of old queens and heroes whom she had never heard of. He spoke of Swanwhite, the queen who had lived before the days of the White Witch and the Great Winter, who was so beautiful that when she looked into any forest pool, the reflection of her face shone out of the water like a star by night for a year and a day afterward. He spoke of Moonwood, the hare, who had such ears that he could sit by Cauldron Pool under the thunder of the great waterfall and hear what men spoke in whispers at Caer Paravel. He told how King Gale, who was ninth in descent from Frank, the first of all kings, had sailed far away into the eastern seas and delivered the Lone Islanders from a dragon, and how, in return, they had given him the Lone Islands to be part of the royal lands of Narnia forever. He talked of whole centuries in which all Narnia was so happy that notable dances and feasts, or at most tournaments, were the only things that could be remembered, and every day and week had been better than the last. And as he went on, the picture of all those happy years, all the thousands of them, piled up in Jill's mind till it was rather like looking down from a high hill onto a rich, lovely plain full of woods and waters and cornfields, which spread away and away till it got thin and musty from distance. So there's a lot I love here. I love thinking about all the stories we haven't heard about all these things. So what was your second?
What I really want to do here, Brent, is read the entirety of chapter 6 of The Silver Chair. This chapter is entitled The Wild Wastelands of the North. I would just read this whole chapter over and over again. It's so beautiful. But I'm going to pick just one passage here. I'm, in fact, going to even elide a little bit here in the middle so it doesn't become overly long. But this is the landscape description that I promised everybody, maybe threatened everybody with here. About the 10th day, they reached a place where the country changed. They came to the northern edge of the moor and looked down a long, steep slope into a different and grimmer land. At the bottom of the slope were cliffs. Beyond these, a country of high mountains, dark precipices, stony valleys, ravines so deep and narrow that one could not see far into them, and rivers that poured out of echoing gorges to plunge sullenly into black depths. It took them some time to reach the foot of the slope, and, when they did, they looked down from the top of the cliffs at a river running below them from west to east. It was walled in by precipices on the far side, as well as on their own, and it was green and sunless, full of rapids and waterfalls. The roar of it shook the earth, even where they stood. And look, just my immediate response to this is, how do I get there? And, you know, how much food do I need to bring with me to go hiking here? I'm in year 4, I guess, of not having been backpacking, basically, since having become a parent. And it's really gnawing at me to not have really been out in the deep wilderness the way that I love to be. And this just sounds like this is this should be on the top of my list. This place is absolutely awesome. But thinking about the writing craft here, right? One of the things that I really like about this is the way that Lewis brings in multiple senses here. So the dominant sense is vision, it's sight, it's what we see. Of course, we are very visual people. I mean, it's, you know, all primates are incredibly visual compared to other types of animals. But Lewis does bring in here as well what it sounds like and what it feels like as well, right? So we get multiple senses here in the way that he's describing this landscape, and that makes it really come alive for me. And this is just, I think, some breathtaking descriptive writing.
Plus, it also makes everything feel alien. Like, there's not anything where they're seeing, like, you know, trees that look nothing like they've ever seen before. And, you know, things are, the sky is not purple, right? But everything is different and strange to them, and kind of overwhelming, but also in a way, intriguing, which just, it's really great, and particularly works for this kind of a kind of sword and sorcery kind of journey story in a great way. In a lot of ways, in some of the other books, we oftentimes were traversing from cluster of people to, or talking animals, but, you know, we'll call them people too. So clustering from like one group of, you know, NPCs you're going to interact with to another in the stories. And we didn't necessarily have a lot of talking about wide open landscapes. And we're told pretty quickly after the Lion, Witch, the Wardrobe that Narnia is relatively small compared to the neighboring countries around it. But the idea then of having this expansive kind of wilderness where it's not just dotted by, you know, cities of, you know, with merchant caravans traveling between them and armies traversing them or anything. It's kind of great. You know, even in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, oftentimes they came to islands where they did encounter things. They might be things that are manifested from their dreams, or they might be, you know, a treasure hoard left over from a dragon. But we didn't have a lot of like purely empty, overgrown or never kind of cultivated by civilization landscapes the way we do in The Silver Chair, which is just leads to those wonderful descriptions like the one you just read.
Well, I think that's a great note on which to end, Brent. Before we close out, let me say thank you again to the Patreon supporter who commissioned this episode. This has been a lot of fun for me. And of course, we're, you know, you and I are only halfway done talking about Narnia. I'm only a third done talking about Narnia. I'm really, really excited for what is to come. But that is going to do it for this episode. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brent Helt. You can find us and our other podcasts at claytemplemedia.com.
Next time, we will be back with Neil Gaiman's Narnia story, The Problem of Susan, which you can find in Fragile Things and also the Neil Gaiman Reader. And until then, pleasant dreams.